Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation. Recorded live during the Spring 2020 Wednesday webinar series.
I'm glad to be here. My name is Rachel Spigarelli, and this class is First Aid for Your Homeschool Woes. I love the book character, Mrs. Piggle-Wiggle by Betty McDonald. Her children's series always encourages and delights me. I felt like it would be appropriate to take the crises we sometimes face as homeschoolers and sprinkle some Mrs. Piggle-Wiggle magic. She's a little bit like Amelia Bedelia, a little bit like Mary Poppins, and she can solve everything. I've been blogging about my Mrs. Spigglewiggle ideas over at my blog, spigglewiggle.blogspot.com. I'd love to hear from you there. And here's my email, rachel@spigarelli.net. In the 10 items that I'm choosing to cover here in this presentation, I hope you'll share with me what other things come to mind as you consider your biggest homeschool woes. I am the parent of 6 children, and I have done homeschooling the whole time, preschool to college prep. I really enjoy homeschooling, and I love getting to know other homeschoolers. So we're going to take Mrs. Spigglewiggle's ideas here and pretend that, like the Mrs. Spigglewiggle of Betty McDonald's creation, we have a chance to ask our questions and express our concerns. So imagine there's a homeschooling helpline you can call in, where you can say, you know, if you're about to give up on homeschooling, press 1. If you need some validation and acknowledgement of your challenges, press 2. If you're not sure you're doing enough, press 3. And if your homeschool just needs more oomph, press 4. The first challenge that we're going to tackle here is that accusation we get, you are the worst mom ever. This challenge happens when our children give us feedback about how much they hate us and how much they are frustrated with what we are doing to them. I feel like this picture really demonstrates what I think I face sometimes when my children are frustrated. This quote from Heather Shoemaker can remind us, I think, the reality of what it is. As homeschoolers, we hear, "I hate you," and she reminds us, it's nothing personal. Take a deep breath and take it for what it is, an angry outburst from a small child who is trying to express herself. These moments pass. The intensity is real, but the meaning is rarely true. She reminds us feelings come and go. As homeschool parents, we wear many different hats, and our children need us to respond in many different ways. No longer is it, "I hate my teacher," or "I hate my assignment." It can become, "I hate you, mother." And Heather Shoemaker, in her excellent book, It's Okay Not to Share, gives us some feedback about some of the things that we might not want to reply when we hear this kind of outburst from our child. She says, "Don't ever say that to me." These are the things we would not want to say. "Don't ever say that to me," or, "Oh, you don't mean that. You don't mean that, honey," or, "You shouldn't feel that way," or, "We don't say hate in this house." Because as a reminder from the esteemed child psychologist, Chaim Gonot, strong feelings do not vanish by being banished. Instead, Heather Shoemaker encourages us to recognize that our child's impulse control is still developing, that their feelings are genuine, but that they might not understand how to express themselves more clearly. She suggests some more effective responses from us as their parents could be, "I know you're feeling this way right now. I know you're really mad at me. Show me how mad you are. Show me on this paper." Or saying, "When I feel like that, this is what helps me." One very powerful technique she suggests is writing down your child's feelings. Putting them on paper helps make the feelings real and clear. It helps the child feel validated. And even if the child already knows how to read and write well, if you take the time to be their secretary and write down their complaints, it will be a great place to begin demonstrating the empathy that they need to be able to move on with processing their feelings, help them get to the fine-tuning of what they're actually feeling. And most of all, it will build a solid foundation for your relationship. the second category, I imagine Mrs. Spigglewiggle being able to conquer with her homeschool helpline would be the slowpoke. Children that lag, dilly-dally and delay, a child that just says, oh, I cannot hurry. And nothing says that to me like this figure etched in marble. I mean, can't you just imagine the mother of this figure telling them to tie their shoes a little faster as you try to get out the door? When I think about the difference between lag, dilly-dally, and delay, to me they seem like three different types of processes that are going on. You have the lag where you're stalling in the hard part of the task, the dilly-dally where you're wasting time or wasting effort, and the delay of not even getting started, dreading the task and putting off the beginning. Carrie Tennis, an author and also a coach for writers, in his excellent book called The Finishing School, talks specifically to writers about what it would take for them to finish their projects. And one of the principles he suggests is that steady progress is what restores your interest in the work. This is the same thing we can say to a child who is struggling with lag in their work. If they find that they just cannot keep going, they can't keep their motivation at all, we can remind them that it's like riding a bike. You need a minimum amount of forward thrust or else you fall over. You really need to be able to be making progress, or all you imagine that your homeschooling efforts are is discouragement, and then you begin to avoid them. So to prevent this stall, one thing that I've tried with my children is 15-minute timers. We use 15-minute timers all the time in our house, because if that's all it is, then that's something. And then they get a taste of success because it was 15 minutes of progress, and then they know that they can stop. That little element of having the clock tell you when it's done rather than the task really makes a difference with the lag. Now turning our attention to dilly-dally, one of the things that sometimes I have to ask myself after I've been barking at the child, hurry, hurry, is, does this task actually need to be hurried? Is there a possibility to slow it down? I found that when I gave one of my children double the amount of time to accomplish the task, everything was better. So dilly-dally requires our need to analyze a little bit more. Is this an issue of distraction? Maybe they need a workstation that has the ability to more completely concentrate. Or perhaps with dilly-dally, we need to use an indirect method to speed it up, such as offering to film them to showcase their skills and abilities to their grandparent or to a cousin on Marco Polo. We also need to remember that with dilly-dally, sabotage-proofing the schedule is essential. We have to have buffers, or else once one kid falls, it's like a stack of dominoes and everything goes. Now, when we consider the third aspect, after lag and dilly-dally, when we come to delay, that's a little bit of a different situation, because here the child is maybe having some self-talk that isn't going really well because they won't even begin. They're putting it off and feeling fearful. So what we really need to do is shift our attention to the inner dialogue. What is the child telling themselves? Is there anything that they can change from the have to the want to? And rather than waiting for enthusiasm to spontaneously spike, we need to really get going in order for the motivation to attend to us. Tim Pitchell he has abundant resources on procrastination online, has been the head of the procrastination research group and written many books on procrastination. And he offers this principle: procrastination is not a time management problem, it's an emotion management problem. So here, rather than focusing on getting the child to do the task, we need to really focus on what the emotional response is for the child, because that is what will determine our speed, the more we understand the context of those kind of principles with lag, dilly-dally, and delay. Now, another principle that I feel like happens with the accusation that you hear as a homeschooler is that this is boring. I am not interested in learning this. I don't even care what we're talking about. I do not want to study this. This picture sums it up for me. I found this in a garden and I just thought it was so exquisite. Obviously, the statue was originally a full bust, but the head is gone. And that's kind of sometimes how it feels when you're homeschooling your child and you feel like they're not actually engaged. You may be filling out the worksheet or doing rote memorization on diagramming sentences, but they're not fully present and you feel like you're, you know, dragging them along. There's no delight in it for either of you. So one of the first principles we have to consider with facing this kind of boredom is what can we do to be more engaged and delighted? Thomas More, in his book, The Re-Enchantment of Everyday Life, tells us that enchantment makes the difference. He says, enchantment invites us to pause and be arrested by whatever is before us. Similarly, Chaim Gonat, the child psychologist, said, we will have an easier time gaining cooperation by changing moods than by changing minds. So taking these two principles together, this idea of enchantment and this idea of cooperation, when we consider our child pushing back about something that they consider boring, what can we do here to be more engaging? And what can we do to change the mood? Julie Bogart is well known for her poetry tea time and her encouragement for parents, homeschooling parents, to dress up, make a treat, light a candle, and read one poem. So what does it look like when we use those same principles of enchantment and mood-changing signals with our own homeschool? I personally run a really math-heavy homeschool. It's really important to me. And so I think you could call me, like, my Mrs. Spigglewiggle magic would be that I do Crayola calculus. I love magic markers when I'm doing my algebraic equations. I always tell my kids, abundant paper is what we're doing. Take as much paper as you need for as many problems, and big, bold colors and a new marker, a new color for each aspect of the problem. So that's something that helps us with our engagement with a subject that my children don't necessarily always want to do, but for me as a homeschooler, it's a priority to teach that subject. Another thing that you'll see in this image is in the corner, I jotted down some notes. My attitude has shifted recently with my homeschool as I've begun keeping an open notebook next to me when I teach my children. And anytime they mention something that they find especially curious or interesting, I write it down. I write down words they stumble across when we're reading out loud, their questions about their vocabulary, any of the curiosity that they bring up. And currently I'm studying Spanish with my children. And, you know, my son was supposed to write down 4 words that he learned in the story we read aloud together. And then I was writing 4 words down as well in my book. And in that brief moment where he had to pause and wait for me to finish writing, I feel like he kind of shifted and had the chance to pause and consider a little longer. And he said to me, you know, in this story, it said levanto for arise. There was a command to a character in the story to rise up. And he said, you know, mom, that sounds so much like leaven. It just makes me think about how yeast rises up the dough. And I was so excited. I thought, that is the engagement that I want. And perhaps that came because he had a little extra time, but certainly the mood helped us. And that's what I'm aiming for in my homeschool. Here, Thomas More describes the principles of enchantment. He says, what most satisfies the soul is that which is captivating, spellbinding, and full of charm. Certainly my homeschooling efforts do not meet this ideal all the time. But having that in mind of being a captivating, spellbinding, and full of charm experience, I think helps us feel encouraged about what we're aiming for in our homeschooling efforts. The other principle here with overcoming boredom is the principle of autonomy. So Chaim Gonat, again, the child psychologist, says the more autonomy, the less enmity. And the more self-dependence, the less resentment of the parent. So perhaps it's fair to say that there may be 2 aspects to the boredom accusation. One aspect is the reality, is there actually something I can change about this as the homeschooling parent? And then perhaps the other question we can ask ourselves is, what could I change so that my child felt more engaged with the work that is uniquely theirs? What could I change to make space for their questions and their interest? Eleanor Duckworth trained under Piaget. She helps run Harvard Research in Child Development and has a collection of essays in a book called The Having of Wonderful Ideas. One thing that she says is that there are two aspects of providing occasions for wonderful ideas. One is being prepared to accept children's ideas, and the other is providing a setting which suggests wonderful ideas to children. In this way, we can be reminded that we can create an environment where we can honor and share those ideas that our children offer us through their questions. Lori Pickert writes an excellent book about project-based homeschooling and being able to engage our children with their own projects and their own questions, where they can follow through with their ideas to conclusion and really feel encouraged to keep studying and overcome their boredom. The next aspect to cover with Mrs. Spigglewiggle's magic is this, I wish I was a baby. I want to be little forever, and I just don't want to grow up. And to me, this image summarizes that thrill of childhood. For our family, we've encountered this a few times where we have an older sibling look at an younger sibling and say, wow, your schoolwork is so easy. Mine is so hard, but yours, I could get that done in like 30 seconds. Oh, I wish mine was that easy. And oh, I wish I wasn't older because this stuff is so hard and I just hate my stuff. We also had this situation come up in my family when one of my daughters decided she wanted to continue being a baby when I had another baby, and she was old enough to talk about it, but also old enough to sneak the pacifier and the bottle and really wanted to continue doing baby things. So we ended up hosting a baby graduation for her, where we had gave her baby books and told memories of her time as a baby and all the things we loved about her being baby. And we had baby corn and baby bell cheeses and all the baby foods we could think of. And we then celebrated and said, now you're no longer a baby and you're moving on. As homeschoolers, we lack these opportunities to have a milestone that is automatic in many public education environments. Instead of being able to say, yes, you have officially finished that subject, or you have moved from the third grade to the fourth grade, it's up to us to create our own milestones and to create our own rites of passage. It's our job to demonstrate both the privileges and responsibilities of growing older. The parents, Adele Faber and Elaine Maslich, were inspired by child psychologist Chaim Gounod. And you're probably familiar with their many books, Siblings Without Rivalry and How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk. They said, children don't need to have their feelings agreed with, but they need to have them acknowledged. And that's the most important role we can offer. When our child says, I wish I was a baby or any other kind of thing, we need to continue acknowledging their feelings and let them hear us validating, because there is truth in what they say. One of the other things that happens as a homeschooler is that you want friendship. When you get going as a homeschooler, you just think, oh, if only we had someone else to join us in this journey. Ah, it would be easier if we had some friends. And oh, what if those friends were exactly like us? Like, they had kids the same ages as our kids, and they all liked the same things. They had the same hobbies, and we could carpool together. They'd live nearby, and they'd have, you know, similar career paths as what we're dealing with for the breadwinner in our family, and everything would be so similar. We'd just be mirror images of each other and live in homeschool happiness and bliss. So certainly, I think this fits in with Betty McDonald's image of Mrs. Pigglewiggle having excess and extremes and having this perfect homeschool family. Although I have never met that perfect homeschool family, I have been so grateful for the friends that we have met. And I agree that having friends does make the journey lighter and easier. There are times, however, when we have to kind of shift our definition of friendship and understand maybe what would it be like if we were more flexible about what kind of friends we need, both for the parent and for the children. Because since we can't meet this extreme of having every child have a friend that maybe meets their gender, matches their gender, matches their age, matches their interests, you know, what can we have? So there are a couple principles that I found have been helpful for me. One is to just be really inviting, to really include with our academics, anything that we can include. Recently, I guess it hasn't been recently, it's been a few years, but I've been running a homeschool book club that got sponsored by the local public library. And that was a great opportunity to be inviting. It was something we definitely could include other people on. And the being sponsored by the library meant that we were in the library the library materials, and families came across us who I never would have met otherwise. Also, it just takes a lot of joining existing clubs. Sometimes when you first start homeschooling, it seems hard to tap into the homeschool network, but to me, perhaps it could be said there are orbits. There's groups where sports families circulate, and a lot of the same families do the same things. Also, larger co-ops often attract a larger group of families, and sometimes tapping into those just for one season or one class can give you a glimpse into the broad variety of families and the many opportunities that wait for you. I think that one of the most important principles for friendship with homeschoolers is to eliminate competition, because none of us want to be compared, and it is defeating to feel like you're trying to do your best and being constantly compared or evaluated by others who homeschool. I mean, the reality of it is we're homeschooling, we're going at it alone. Like, that's the principle behind homeschooling. We're saying, I think I can do this, and I think I can do it on my own without the system. So I feel like this quote from Brené Brown really summarizes. It rings true for me as a homeschooler, and I hope it will for you as well. She said in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, one of the greatest barriers to connection is the cultural importance we place on going it alone. Going it alone. Somehow we've come to equate success with not needing anyone. Many of us are willing to extend a helping hand, but we're very reluctant to reach out for help when we need it ourselves. It's as if we've divided the world into those who offer help and those who need help. The truth is that we are both. So I hope that resonates with you and reminds you that you don't need to go at it alone in homeschooling, whether it's virtual friends or friends that are much older or much younger than you. You may not find that perfect match, but it will make a difference. To me, whenever I think about friends, I think about the promise from President Ezra Taft Benson, a leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He said, men and women who turn their lives over to God will find he can make a lot more out of their lives than they can. He will deepen their joys, expand their visions, quicken their minds, strengthen their muscles, lift their spirits, multiply their blessings, increase their opportunities, comfort their souls, raise up friends, and pour out peace. I hope that reminds you that it will be possible to make friends on your journey. Now, let's turn to one of those exasperated moments when your child throws down the pencil and declares he is done. He says, my schoolwork is impossible and it is never going to get better. To me, this picture is an image of impossibility. This is Las Citas in Sevilla, Spain. And this structure is the largest wooden structure in the world. It is so unfathomable. You can't, it's too large to even photograph in a single image. It looks like mushrooms floating above the city, and it gives shade like an umbrella. The most interesting thing about this structure was that it was built in a place where there was originally a marketplace that had fallen into disrepair. So the city decided to dig down and do an underground parking lot and then build up just a new everyday marketplace. But it turns out as they went to dig down, there were tremendous amounts of Roman ruins because it is Spain, and they felt that they needed to preserve it. So they decided to set up an international competition, and the winner could only touch down in four places. into this Roman ruin area that they were excavating and had to be able to support a structure with very few supports. The project went through a tremendous amount of delay and financial problem and has a very interesting story if you want to look it up. But for me, I look at this image and I think about something impossible that was actually accomplished. And that's how sometimes our homeschooling can feel. But the most important thing we need to pay attention to is the words never and always. Those are our red flags. Martin Seligman is the father of positive psychology. He's the one who coined the term learned helplessness. And he says the basis of optimism does not lie in positive phrases or images of victory, but in the way you think about causes. What this means is if we want to have a positive train of thought, we need to have a positive, we need to have words that help us recognize what is going on inside ourselves and in the world. He divides those words into three categories. They are permanent, pervasive, and personal. So if something is permanent, that's the difference between saying sometimes versus always. Permanent means, you know, every single time. Pervasive is specific versus global. So pervasive means, you know, I'm not just struggling with this one area, but I am struggling with everything in my life. And personal means it's not just about what's happened, like it was a difficult day on the soccer field. It's I am flawed as a human being. So by taking this vocabulary of permanent, pervasive, and personal, and paying closer attention to the words our children use when they're talking about their challenges, we can recognize these red flags of pessimism. So if the child sits down to do their math and says, I can't ever do math. Every single time I try it, I fail. And I know it's because I'm flawed as a human being. You would be able to see that those are permanent, pervasive, and personal comments. Rather, if the child is able to verbalize it like this, or you could coach them in being able to verbalize it. Today, in this moment, I'm having a challenge with understanding this portion of the concept. This does not describe my personality or reflect my potential. You keep it specific to the moment. You keep it only about what we're talking about. It's not sweeping. It's not personal. It's the fact that trig identities are frequently difficult for many math students, and you keep it about today. You'll have so much more success. And of course, as with anything mental health, the more we teach ourselves to make these changes, the more it'll be easier to teach our children as well. Ultimately, Martin Seligman tells us that when you teach your child optimism, you are teaching him to know himself, to be curious about his theory of himself and of the world. You are teaching him to take an active stance in his world and to shape his own life rather than be a passive recipient of what happens. I feel like this is so encouraging that optimism is this tool to really help us be able to succeed. That it gives understanding that the child wouldn't otherwise have. And paying attention to those three causes will make the biggest difference. Obviously, that's a very brief overview to a complicated topic, but I encourage you to dig into the optimistic child if you want more information about that. Now, let's take it when you're ready to quit. When you, as a homeschooler, you're like, wow, I actually didn't know what I was signing up for. Like, I had no idea. The burden would be so hard and the road so long, I am done. Or maybe in your house, it sounds like, I'm going to go down to the public school and sign you guys up. I am done with this. Now, this image is a little bit complicated to explain. So let me dig in here. This is from Neil Moore, an Australian play-based piano instructor. He's created an innovative method for piano, and he talks a lot in this small book he wrote called Music and the Art of Long-Term Relationships. He talks about what it would be like to have a long-term relationship with a process, not just a long-term relationship with a person. And in his book, he's talking about having a long-term relationship with playing piano itself. But for us as homeschoolers, what we can consider is what is it like to have a long-term relationship with homeschooling? So Neil Moore says, you know, there's principles that follow every long-term relationship. There's peaks, there's valleys, there's plateaus. Sometimes they last a long time. Sometimes there's a short time. And that's normal. He said that the most important thing we need to do is distinguish the method from the relationship. So if you are at a breaking point with your homeschooling and so frustrated that you don't even want to go on, what could you do to change the dynamic? Is it about the methods? Is it something about the curriculum you're using or the expectations, your family schedule? Something that could change about the actual method you're using to homeschool? Or is it the idea of homeschooling itself, which is a huge responsibility, that willingness to shoulder the educational load and say, I think we can do this without support of an education system. Neil Moore says, challenges are a naturally occurring requirement in all long-term relationships. Long-term relationships are designed to be good and then not good. They're designed to be wonderful and then not so wonderful. The only way to have, he says, music, I'm saying homeschool, as a lifelong companion is to consciously, actively, deliberately engage in a long-term relationship with homeschool. So that's my invitation to you. The next time you feel like you are ready to throw the towel in and you're just not wanting to continue, is to really say, what would it be like to consciously, actively, deliberately engage in a long-term relationship with homeschool? You expect to have hiccups. You expect to have those difficult times. You also need to maybe verbalize your motivations about why you're homeschooling in the first place and have as many physical reminders of why you homeschool as possible, whether those come in the form of pictures or whether, you know, it's a rock or, a potted plant, anything that reminds you of the growth that is yet to come. But also note the ebb and flow of your enthusiasm. Are Tuesdays especially hard? Or is it just before lunch? Is it once you're doing one of the English grammar? What is it that usually triggers your discouragement? And that, again, can help you separate out the method from the relationship. Now, here's another aspect of homeschooling. This idea of small steps, that it's the minimum and it's all you could do. Like, you want to do more, but every single day feels so hard. This is a small corner of the Spanish palace, Alhambra, and in Granada, in southern Spain. And if you look, these tiles are done with very small squares. The squares are nothing special. There aren't even that many colors being used. But the intricate way that it was laid so carefully with attention to detail, even though it's so very old, you can tell that this is a meaningful corner of this palace. And I feel like it's the same with our small steps as a homeschooler. Each little brick in the foundation, each little morning that we practice handwriting or do a few math problems or read aloud with a child, feels like maybe it isn't very much, but it's a tile into our intricate design. Sarah McKenzie is a fellow homeschooler with a large family, and she talks about avoiding anxiety and frenzy. She says, participate in slow, sane education. In her book, Teaching from Rest, she illustrates what it would be like to slow down and consider the big picture about why you're homeschooling and to remember to keep yourself focused so that you're not too disappointed in yourself. Now, President Eyring, another leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, talks about this feeling of being overwhelmed. He's specifically talking about callings in the church and responsibilities to serve, but I think it applies equally well to homeschooling. He says there will be times when you will feel overwhelmed. One of the ways you will be attacked is with the feeling that you are inadequate. And then he follows up with, you are inadequate, and continues, but you have access to more than your natural capacities, and you do not work alone. This idea of being attacked with the feeling that we're inadequate, but then the truth that we actually are inadequate, is a paradox that takes some wrapping your mind around. What does it mean to recognize that we never actually can fully educate our child on our own, but that every effort is also worth it simultaneously. I think it's worth pondering on. One of the things I really like about President Eyring's example is this idea to reach for revelation and reach for capacities beyond our own. One of the most important things to me about the revelation we need in homeschool is that homeschool is not a cut and paste situation. Just because it worked for another family doesn't mean it will automatically work for you. Just buying the same curriculum and doing it at the same time every day may not equate to success in your home. President Eyring says that when we are seeking revelation about what we're doing, he said, seeking it out, studying it out, requires a degree of patience, of labor, and of persistence commensurate with the value of what you seek. I actually hung this on my bathroom mirror because the words mean so much to me when I think about those small tiles that I'm trying to lay each day. It takes a degree of patience, of labor, and of persistence commensurate with the value of what I seek. So I know that I want this outcome of homeschooling, and I want the opportunities to build relationships with my children and enjoy learning with them. And that encourages me to go on, even if the steps are small and it feels like each day may not be very magnificent. The next aspect I wanted to cover was about being really angry as a homeschooler. What it happens when you're a mother that's angry and you're frustrated with your children and you're unhappy and you find yourself not being the kind of homeschool parent that you'd like to be. One of the things that sometimes I find myself mistakenly saying to myself is that a good homeschool parent wouldn't yell at her children. But in truth, my anger is a signal that something might be wrong. And when I pause to acknowledge the anger, it gives me a chance to think about what is really going on. Marshall Rosenberg said that anger is not the problem. It's the thinking that goes on within us when we are angry that is the problem. When I'm angry, I know I need to slow down and look at what I'm telling myself, and I need to translate the judgments, the thinking that's going inside myself, and to get in touch with my needs. Chaim Gnot tells us that the emotionally healthy parents are not saints. They're aware of their anger and they respect it. They use their anger as a source of information. Their words are congruent with their feelings and they do not hide their feelings. So we don't want to mix up what people do, the trigger, with the cause of our anger. Rather than saying, "You make me feel," we can say instead, "I feel as I do because I'm telling myself." So it's how we look at the situation that creates our anger, not the stimulus itself. So if we were to list the judgments that are likely to go on inside of us when we are angry, it might sound like this. When I feel this emotion, it's because I'm meeting some universal needs, and would you be able to help with that? So every time we get angry, we are disconnected from our needs. And we need to build our vocabulary of our needs to change the conversation. To build our need literacy with the needs inventory from the Center of Nonviolent Communication is a place where I begin. Marshall Rosenberg leads the Nonviolent Communication website. And he says that we need to remind ourselves of these two questions. What do I want the child to do differently? And what would I like the child's reasons to be for acting as I would like them to act? So being aware of those needs is what will make the difference for helping us respond to our anger in a meaningful way. Now, the last category I want to cover is measuring up. Homeschoolers are constantly saying, or at least frequently saying, "How are my kids doing compared to their peers? Are we actually succeeding? What is going on for, you know, if we looked at the bigger picture, would we find that we have success?" So imagine tattooing a ruler on your forearm, and with it, you could quickly evaluate your children. Each time they'd stand close to you, you could conveniently size them up. Like Midas's greedy golden touch, this would destroy our children. They don't need to be constantly evaluated and measured. But in our desperate attempts to define our success, we sometimes search for numbers to objectively tally our studies. And we often reach for a test score. But the test scores are actually a siren call. We think that a high test score would validate our homeschooling efforts and offer us encouragement to continue, or a low test score. But we have to remember that a low test score could potentially castigate us, or make us feel like a failure, or make us feel like not continuing. Either way, outcomes with a measuring stick are used to compare ourselves to others, and they shift our focus away from learning itself. Alfie Kohn is an outspoken education critic, and he talks a lot about the preoccupation with tests and grades. He says that tests emerge from, and in turn contribute to, our predilection for three things: quantifying, controlling, and competing. So first, considering the way testing quantifies, we think that learning is something we can measure. I know I've been in experiences where I didn't understand, and then all of a sudden I understand, and I understand not just what I just studied, but so much more. We can't easily quantify that kind of authentic learning that happens. The idea of testing emerging from our desire to control, Alfie Kohn specifically references teachers who use tests in their classrooms to force a child to study and force a child to have accountability. And that's when it's used for controlling. And lastly, for competing, we all know those test scores can mean a lot. And many people feel curious about our test scores and wonder what's happened with the test scores. It ends up being something that is like a barcode on your back and can define a lot about you. If I were to be honest, I'd actually say that avoiding tests as a definition, like as a defining aspect of character, was one of the main reasons why I decided to homeschool. So I actually decided to write a poem about testing. I was imagining, you know, Betty McDonald's Mrs. Piggle-Wiggle in the spirit of excess that she does when she, you know, I could imagine her coming up my driveway with this basket full of exams and just piling it on my table and saying, here, take all these tests and then you'll be cured from ever wanting tests again. So my poem is called The Exorbitant Extent of Exams. Proficiency tests, placement tests, diagnostic and achievement tests, performance-based assessments, true applications of real-world stress, formative testing and summative testing, blood pressure, vision, and pulse while resting, oral exams and written exams, multiple choice and fill in the blank, structured as pre-test, post-test, and pop quiz. Some will struggle while some will whiz, beyond IQ tests and driving tests. We can measure knowledge, aptitude, and fitness. Lengthy essays during high-stakes evaluations, closed book and open book across the nation, tests that get harder as you score correctly, and tests that, as you fail, are easier correctly. What are the results? After this, are we better? Or are these scores our modern fetter? Perhaps we trust the numbers too much to determine if we are enough. Shake off the shackles of your testing. Believe you are personally progressing. Consider only your individual gifts without measuring your length and width. I feel like that poem, I wrote it as I considered the fact that we don't actually want test scores. That's not actually what we want. We want a window into our strengths, and maybe a small glimpse of what could change in our homeschool, because we know truly what might need to change already. If we were to pause and really think about it, we already have enough information about the things we know we need to offer our children, or the small shifts that we could do. And we don't want a test score to beat us across the head with that information. We want to be encouraged in our work. One thing that really surprised me from Alfie Kohn's writing was learning the etymology of the word assessment. The assessor originally was someone who sat next to the judge during court. Sitting next to the judge, he could take accurate notes of the losses and gains of the equipment or property and the cost of things. So originally, the word assess meant to sit beside. Only later did it take on the connotation of being evaluation and considering the worth of something. So in homeschooling, one of our great opportunities is the chance to sit beside our own child, close enough to them to understand just how much they understand. So the simple alternative to testing is just awareness. Alfie Kohn says, a teacher who is paying attention, listening to students' conversations, following their projects, reading their writing, will never need to administer a test. So instead of saying, are my kids learning enough? Are they behind their peers? Are we doing all the academic tasks that are expected of us? We can ask instead, how will I acknowledge my child's good attributes? How will I increase their engagement? And how will I celebrate our progress? Homeschool coach Julie Bogart offers this in her book, The Brave Learner. She says, rather than testing at the end of each year, as many states require, we can circumvent that by doing a sketch by narrative. So she said, shift your gaze from measurement by rubric to sketch by narrative. So she suggests that during a 24-hour period, we list everything that happens for the child, the questions they ask, the time they get up, their favorite foods, what brings them delight, who they like to talk about, which friends they spend time with, what things they struggle with in their siblings, any of the patterns that we see with our child, and we just write down as much information as we can for that 24-hour period. If we did this every 2 months, every 4 months, twice a year even, this would give us such a clear picture rather than being just the snapshot that testing intends to be. Writing a sketch by narrative would actually give us the opportunity to have a moving picture, a full image of the development, and be able to see changes over time. Our best hope for our homeschool is to forget about measuring our child and to move forward with the delight we have in the individual progress and to separate the endeavors of homeschooling from our test scores. Okay, so I've just talked about 10 big areas, and I know I moved pretty quickly. We talked about children yelling that they hate their mother, children that won't hurry, children that are bored, children that don't want to grow up. We talked about the search for good homeschool friends and the ability to conquer our own pessimism and the pessimism of our children. We talked about the long-term relationship with homeschool, being satisfied with small steps of progress, acknowledging our anger, and the fears about measuring up. I'd love to take your questions at this time. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Rachel. As always, that is just fabulous and such important information. We do have two questions that have popped up, so I'm going to read you the first one.
Okay.
The first one is, what if much of the discouragement you experience comes from your husband and his disapproval with what he observes of your homeschooling efforts? I feel like I'm doing the best I can and that we are steadily making progress. He doesn't think they are progressing as much as they should be.
Wow. Thank you for that thoughtful question. I'm with you on that. Any time that we have to prove our progress to someone else, that really, really cuts down on our enthusiasm. When we feel like we have to be displayed for our progress, I think you're right to acknowledge that that is a very difficult part of it. I guess the place to start with that is really trying to understand what his expectations are. You know, if there's something he could verbalize about, you know, is it that he feels anxious in general about the homeschool? I've talked to some friends who say, you know, my My husband is, you know, from an ethnicity where he believes we need an academic rigorous education. And he sees what I do with my children and says, that's not academically rigorous. But the more specific you could be to it, like, do you want them to be taking geometry by the time they're 15? Or do you want them writing these essays? Is there something we could do to help demonstrate the rigor that you're hoping for? I think even more than that, though, the question would be, what can you do to team up? Because is there some aspect of the homeschooling that your husband would like to be more involved with? I think the more that we're involved with homeschooling, our expectations change. And the more that we see what it actually feels like to carry the load and to deal with maybe a child who feels like it's boring or a child who is discouraged about it, we'll find a difference. And so perhaps there's one aspect of it that he would be willing to take on. You know, as an example, one, I'm not sure how old the person who asked this question, how old the children are, but one thing that my husband recently took on as a responsibility in our homeschool was that my 8-year-old wanted to go through the book, The Way Things Work, and he wanted to analyze each one of the pages and talk through the plow and the wheel and the axle and the transmission. And so that's something he does with my husband. And sometimes it takes 15 minutes, sometimes it takes 45, sometimes they build it with Legos, but they talk it through, maybe do a few YouTube videos. And it's something that's really accessible and interesting to my husband and to my son. They're both really motivated to do it. And so it's not something I feel like I'm forcing either of them to do. So perhaps there's something like that that could be a good stepping stone for your husband, because as he feels more engaged in the challenges you face, perhaps then he will be willing to change his opinion on the progress. But I think regardless of whether or not he changes his opinion, the more confident you are in the changes you are making and, you know, really honoring the truth that you believe you are making a difference for your children and knowing that your children benefit from time with you, when you're confident of those things, it's contagious. And it may take him some time, and I regret that you're facing that criticism, but hopefully he'll be able to acknowledge it.
Thanks again, Rachel. So the next two questions are on your poem that you just shared. The first one is, will you share your poem? And the other question, first a statement and then a question, was just that your poem made me cry. Thank you for sharing. Can I find that one on your website? And what is your website? So if you could share that again, because not everybody maybe was here at the very beginning.
Yes, of course. Yes, thank you, Lisa. I'm glad you guys liked my poem. I admit it's a little bit hard to read a poem out loud in a room all by yourself. And I did feel a little nervous about presenting that. My blog that I've been running about these aspects and other things I like writing about homeschooling is called spigglewiggle.blogspot.com. So that's spigglewiggle.blogspot.com. I also have this available in the handout that I created for LDSHE, which I think is certainly through the emails that LDSHE has been sending out, but perhaps it's also posted on their website. Also, I'm happy to send you a copy if you have trouble accessing it in any other way. My email address is rachel@spigarelli.net. Rachel is R-A-C-H-E-L at Spigarelli, S-P-I-G-A-R-E-L-L-I.net. I'm sorry that the end of the slideshow cut out there, because I have all the resources listed, the books that I mentioned, the authors, and other resources. So go ahead and find me at spigglewiggle.blogspot.com.
Great. Thanks, Rachel. That seems to be all the questions we have. We really appreciate you coming and talking to us today, and we appreciate all those that have joined in. And remember, this will be uploaded to YouTube by Friday, so if you want to watch it again. And thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.